Thanks, Rachel. Bodies in the sand. Tropical drink melting in your hand. We'll be falling in love to the
Makes me want to not go away if I have to hear that song at a Club Med. Travel magazines are everywhere, enticing us with glossy pictures of white sandy beaches and beautiful blue water. Their headlines urge us not to miss out on exotic escapes, one-of-a-kind adventure, hidden cultures. And who would want to?
Travel writer Chuck Thompson spent years writing these stories of fascinating cities, charming locales, golden days and purple nights. And he hated it. He says the best travel stories are the ones left out. You know, the great places to get drunk or find, shall we say, friendship for the evening, or staying in hotel rooms that double as ant colonies. What I'm describing him is what Anthony Bourdain did to the world of restaurants, Chuck is doing for travel journalism. He's the author of Smile When You're Lying, Confessions of a Rogue Travel Writer. Chuck, you've written for a ton of magazines, Maxim, Atlantic, Esquire, National Geographic.
Geographic Adventure. I don't want to upset the people at the famed Yellow Book. I'm one of their lower titles. But
you're a down market friend.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done a lot of travel writing for some in-flight magazines as well, and just sort of made my way around the world letting people pay me to go write about these places.
So when did you notice, or did you maybe you noticed right away that maybe travel writing was not what it was appeared to be?
Probably about a year or two into it. You know, I got into it because I wanted to be, I think like most people, a writer, and you think travel writer sounds pretty cool. But what you find out pretty quickly into the game is that you're not so much a writer as you are sort of churning out glorified ad copy. I mean, you're basically there to satisfy the needs of the advertisers, because that's who really keeps – if you're talking about travel magazines, I'm going to talk about travel books right now. We can talk about that if you like. But for magazines in particular, what drives the editorial is basically the advertisers.
But a magazine like – including a magazine like Esquire or even Maxim, don't they want, you know, wild, debaucherous things?
Yeah, well, I always say that the best travel writing you're going to find is going to be in magazines that aren't in travel magazines. The best travel magazines – best travel writing is not in travel magazines,
right?
Because they're not necessarily beholden to those advertisers. Now, if you want to talk about men's magazines or women's magazines, I would probably trust them for my travel information, but not my information about cars or lipstick or things like that they're trying to promote.
Right.
Look
who takes out the most ads and then take a grain of salt. But what about big, respectable newspaper travel sections? I mean, I know they don't, for instance, like some of the magazines do, who the travel writers get everything paid for. Mm. The New York Times will never allow anyone to take a junket. Does that help in the quality of the writing?
Yes and no. I can't speak for the New York Times because I've never written for them. But for a lot of daily newspapers, they don't pay very much money to their travel writers. So for one thing, you get sort of a lousy writing, which is my other beef about travel writing. It's just kind of junk writing, you know.
Yeah.
And one of the problems is newspapers don't like paying for it. And what a lot of dailies do, again, I'd rather exempt the New York Times because I have no knowledge of this, but what a lot of dailies do, rather than pay a travel writer to go turn out their feature story on Jamaica or Norway, one of their staffers might get an extra couple of days of vacation on his trip, his or her honeymoon or his family trip back there, and then crank out the piece. But it's interesting that you bring up the idea of there are magazines and newspapers that very sanctimoniously say, we will never accept comps, no matter what. We're not going to take freebies from these things, and that keeps our editorial content pure. But the fact is, for the really large ones, they don't have to take comps because they're getting so much money in advertiser revenue. And if you want, you know, we talked about some travel magazines a little bit.
Yeah,
I can
please
show you. All right, look, here's this is a copy of Islands magazine, which is on the newsstand right now. And if you go through and look at some of the what the ad content is, you'll see that this issue, and right on their cover, it's 15 Ultimate Romantic Escapes. That's their big feature package for this issue, right? And if you look at all the advertisers, they're all geared toward the romance of travel. Here's one from the Hilton Caribbean. And, you know, pay attention to some of the language that's in this ad. They're talking about the sort of romance of their travel with sunrise swims, candlelight dinners, and moonlight fun, right? And here's another one from somewhere in Antigua that talks about the ideal romantic getaways with your own private beach. Here's one that's just photographed, but you guys can see. I'm sorry, we're on radio, but I worked at Maxim for a long time, and
yes,
that photo
and
there
be,
would do.
She'd be in Maxim.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, there's no question about what this couple's
two
getting.
Essentially topless people.
Yeah, what they're getting ready to do, right? So we've got the private beach, we've got the moonlit fun, we've got the candlelight dinners. All right, so now let's go back and look at some of the actual editorial content, which is what you're reading and figuring that, well, nobody's taking comps here. This mm-hmm. is all sort of above board. Here is in the editorial letter, this guy is announcing the package and saying he's giving us his definition of what travel romance is. It's an incredible dinner. It's a swim in the ocean at midnight. It's a candlelight dinner. We go back to in these sort of features here. It's a beach for two, a private getaway island, a candlelight dinner under a blanket of stars.
So basically, you could take the ad copy and you could take the editorial copy, flip them, and no one would know the difference.
Well, it's the same words. It's the same buzzwords. I mean, the ad, the advertiser content is pushing the editorial content. And what you get, when the writers become aware of this and sort of this need becomes obvious to them, what you get are a lot of writers, you get words of writers groping for the language of advertisers. And so it's this, all this hyperbole. It's what a couple of travel writers, these aren't my words, although I wish they were, they call them the sort of witless puffery or the sun-dappled barf of travel writing. And there's a lot of that, you know. And
how many ways can you describe a sunset or a sunrise?
Well, that's a problem.
I mean, it's kind of the problem when you get to the Caribbean, like, there's not that much to do. We have to just look at the sunrise and sunset.
You know what? This is we're getting into more of a question of writing, but there's ways to do it and not necessarily hyperbolize it. I'll give you a few examples here. And here's in this package. These are just a few ways that travel writers just go way over the top and trying to sell, right? And keep in mind, this is all edit copy. I'm not talking ads here. But in this package right here, you know, you can see I've marked just about every page, right? This woman talks about a bathtub in her hotel room that's so deep she might drown in it. Okay, if there's
ooh,
one or
how'd
two,
how'd they come up with that one?
Well, but no one's going to drown in the bathtub, right? And this guy talks about this vacation where he's in fear that he's going to quit his job and run away from his life and live on that side. Well, that's nonsense.
Does he actually use the phrase "chuck it all"?
Yeah, probably. Last month, here's a guy snorkeling on the Great Barrier Reef on an adventure that would make Jacques Cousteau green with envy. Okay, and it's not bad to see one or two of these things, but it's every.
I think that happens in all specialized writing because when you read music critics, everybody's got crunchy guitars.
Oh, the crunchy. Yeah.
You know what I mean? God. So I'm wondering if this is just—is it the writer's fault or is it the editor's fault? Should the editors be pushing back and saying, "Hey, give me a more descriptive picture"?
Well,
hit the thesaurus, buddy.
Well, I think they got the crunchy out of the thesaurus. But
probably, you're right.
Part of it is, you know, there's a lot of good writers out there. And I complain a lot about travel writing in this book. It's not exclusively what it's about, but I do bitch about it. But there are a lot of really good travel writers out there, right? But the problem is there are a lot of bad writers out there. And the problem with editors is, for the most part, it's like everything else. They're overworked and underpaid, right? They're on deadline and they got to crank out 8 stories in the next 2 weeks. I mean, there's just not time often to go back and just really rework these
things. I think your point is also that it's not that editors really want to have this great copy. Everyone knows where their bread is buttered and it's fine to just churn out drivel. Now, there is a good piece of travel writing I read called Smile When You're Lying, which is your book. And the difference isn't that just that you avoid cliches or have better adjectives. It's the content of the things you write about. It's the stories you tell, as they said in Stripes, which will never get anywhere. Like, when you go to – how could anyone go to Thailand and even if they don't partake in any of it, not notice that there are a lot of hookers around? And you never read that in the travel writing.
Yeah, you know what? And I went to Thailand. I was saying that I had no intention of getting involved in that circuit and I didn't really get – I guess we should define get involved, right? But, I mean, I didn't go over there on the sex tour trade. But I was curious about it. I wanted to see what it looked like. And so I just sort of looked at it. I've gotten a lot of grief about even describing that in this book.
But you know, it's called reporting, which supposedly what travel writing is a version of.
I get called a misogynist for just sort of noticing.
Yeah, there's
that
a guy happening. Somebody on Amazon's got a problem with you.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, there are. Well, look, it's a very – we live in a really weird – we're sexually repressed country, right? I mean, it's the big issue. It's funny to me that I'd say that the story about the prostitute in Thailand and there's a sort of an encounter with this gay guy in the Philippines. Those two stories maybe account for whatever 9 pages of this book, but I'd say they appear in virtually every
That's
sort of.
Well, I highlight
because it's unusual. The point is that other travel book.
Yeah, right.
We'll write about it.
It upsets someone. And the one highlighted phrase I have in the whole book is, quote, "My brush with gay machete sex notwithstanding." But you won't get that in Islands Magazine unless you will and I miss something. But before you said, hey, if you want to talk about travel books, I do. You have a great riff on The Lonely Planet in particular.
Well, I just don't – The Lonely – look, first, I'll say this, my caveat. Lonely Planet – what they do is excellent, probably the best in the business. I mean, they cover locations like nobody else. I think you can totally rely upon the information in there and the veracity of it, 100%, no problem with that. What I don't like is this really pompous, arrogant, self-righteous air they take. They're really preachy with their readers. You know, they sort of tell you how to behave. I think I mentioned in the book that there was a piece in one of their London books that was instructing their readers not to stare at locals on the train, as though we were a bunch of third graders, you know, out for a field trip. And they kind of pepper that. Those books and their copy with that sort of stuff over and
like
over.
Exclamation points and clean up your trash.
Yeah,
after
right. They're constantly berating you for not respecting the wildlife or the locals or something. It's just incredible.
And these are Lonely Planet travel readers. These are the people who bought the books. As you said, it seems like they hate their readers.
Well, the other thing they do is they bitch about tourists constantly. And one thing that really annoys me are tourists who bitch about tourists. I mean, look, we're all tourists to some degree, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can call yourself a traveler or an adventurer or whatever. It's all basically some version of the same thing. And it's a thing that I like. I'm not complaining about it. But it really drives me nuts when it's either, you know, the backpacker squatting for 2 weeks in a hut in Cambodia, turning up his or her nose at the guy in the five-star resort up on the hill. And it works the other way, too, of course. There's the snooty guy at the Raffles Hotel in Singapore that wouldn't dream of, you know, putting on the flip-flops and walking through a neighborhood. That sort of bothers me, too.
I'm with you on some of those guides. Rick Steves, I would see on my honeymoon, I was in Florence, and I kept thinking, you know, there's things in the guides that say things like, oh, don't go see the David. Go to this park. Off the blah, 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 blah.
How
and
would
I kept
you
thinking,
want to see the David? Why would anyone see the
it's
David?
It's fantastic. The Uffizi Gallery is fantastic. Of course you want to see the David. It's really great to go see this little statue in the park behind the moss and everything. But I'm with you with the judgmental tourism.
Yeah,
books.
And Lonely Planet is the pinnacle of judgmental travel. And, you know, I use the thing in the book, too, where their very first addition to Costa Rica, they talk about how unspoiled and wild and unpopulated and bereft of tourism it is. And they love that. Well, they are one of the big people who helped market Costa Rica as a sort of nature tourism destination. Well, if you look at their books now, all they do is complain every time about all these parks that they used to tell you were unspoiled, nobody's here. Now they gripe about because all the people are here. Well, they made a lot of money off of it.
Maybe you shouldn't have written a book about
it.
Yeah,
no kidding.
Let's set aside travel writing for a second. Let me just add, give me an overrated and underrated in terms of destinations.
I like Panama quite a lot. I like the Philippines quite a lot. Panama, boy, a magazine called Escape, which is no longer in business, tried to send me down there for a couple years, and I almost never turned down work, man. I'll write the oral history of Jokic if you want to pay me to do it, man. But I just, for some reason, I was kind of freaked out. I didn't want to go down to Panama. But when I went there, the minute I got off the plane, I was like, what kind of idiot was I to not want to come down here? It's fantastic. I mean, it's talk about wildlife and friendly people and the usual kind of stuff. Overrated, I'm not a big fan of the Caribbean. I spent an entire chapter in the book outlining my complaints about it. I'm not saying that people shouldn't like the Caribbean. If they like it, they like it. But I don't. And that's part of the confessions, part of the subtitle of this book, The Confessions of a Rogue Travel Writer, is, you know, for a travel writer to come out and say that they think the Caribbean sucks is kind of suicide, right?
Right.
And I don't like Vegas much either. And if there's a couple of travel magazines out there that are kept exclusively in business by Las Vegas advertisers, right?
Well, here are the things that I like about the Caribbean.
Okay, yeah, let's do it.
You ready? It's warm, I'm not working, and there's a beach. It's close to the East Coast, so.
I can't argue with that, you know, and it is sort of, I'm from the West Coast, and I guess it is to some degree what Mexico and Baja and that sort of thing is to West Coasters. You know, it's a two-hour flight or 2.5, whatever it is. And I totally get that, man. But, you know, I'm not one of these guys, I'm not one of these people that is content to kind of slather myself with oil and lay on a beach. I get really bored with that. I've never been that kind of guy. So that bothers me.
You're right. And people reading the books aren't that type of guy because you don't need to know that much. If there's a beach and there's oil, you could be happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they don't need that level of detail.
It's called Galveston, Texas. No.
It's called a sun lamp and a roof.
Yeah, right.
Well, anyway, if you are interested in good travel writing, we recommend your book, Smile When You're Lying, Chuck Thompson, Confessions of a Rogue Travel Writer. Thanks a lot for being in, Chuck.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, that does it for this hour. We appreciate you listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're available to you all the time online at our blog and our website, npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Mike Pasca. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.